Barry Swigum on the Hotel Vancouver and the World War II veterans that took over in the 1940s, funded by CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
Here's a newspaper photo in the Vancouver Sun. You can see five young men and one woman in buttoned-up overcoats and ties holding signs. They're picketing in front of the building.
Here's the picture. Open this hotel for homeless veterans. Empty hotel, something homeless veterans, civic disgrace. Shelter our fighting men. Open the Hotel Vancouver. Empty bedrooms in the old hotel. End government, buck passing. Open this hotel, ex-servicemen. So there was a lot of feeling that that somebody had to do something.
We had a meeting at the Legion over on Seymour Street, and we said, well, let's go over and just march into that old Vancouver hotel and get some attention.
So 35 ex-soldiers at the meeting agreed to do it.
I led the parade, and when it came to the soldier on the gate, we told him what we were going to do. We were going to take over, so just get out of the way.
Two lone guards obviously could do nothing to stop this movement.
They decided then that they would let us stay in the hotel.
Right.
And we did.
The victorious veterans hung up a 15-foot by 3-foot banner outside reading, "Action at last. Veterans, rooms for you. Come and get it." And by evening, the Spanish Grill and ballroom were thumping. The vets had organized a dance, and more than 100 of them bunked down in the hotel. And so that was the start of the occupation.
Well, boys, here it is.
And as soon as they were successful, under the leadership of Bob McEwen, the troop wired the news to Prime Minister Mackenzie King.
I understand that the federal Minister for Veteran Affairs came very quickly to Vancouver once he realized what was going on.
They really didn't want anything to get started. They really didn't want to give any ammunition to any kind of socialist tendencies or something. So they, you know, they were going to help the veterans out anyway. They didn't want any revolution started, yeah.
There's no way during the Great Depression they would have handed over a downtown hotel of, like, you know, several hundred rooms to a group of unemployed homeless men. But then that's what they were doing suddenly, you know what, like not even 15 years later.
The day the minister came into Vancouver, a blizzard swept through the city, making it even harder to force the men back on the streets.
And then the city and the federal government combined to provide the money you needed to maintain and keep this hotel open.
In the next few weeks, similar demonstrations happened in other Canadian cities. A petition circulated calling on the federal government to build 250,000 low-rental housing units. The CBC reported here from Ottawa.
The veterans and their families who took over two quack barracks in Ottawa met with no opposition, and now they are comfortably settled in their new homes and apparently intend to stay.
So we stayed there, and then the merchants, restaurateurs and people like that down Granville Street all sent us food. So we had the sympathy of everybody, I think.
One merchant donated 4 pounds of butter.
The merchants brought all kinds of things. They brought food and sandwiches and coffee and provided, you know, free meals, and people donated hotel mattresses and blankets, and it was very well supported by the public. I mean, they did things in an orderly fashion. People had to register. It wasn't like total chaos or anything.
And by Tuesday, 1,400 people were registered. At first, the hotel was for servicemen only.
A lot of them were wanting to set up a life, live with their families, get married. Yeah, so it wasn't just the servicemen, but it was also their wives who needed a place to stay.
One of the first families to stay in the hotel were the Chapmans, with three young children. They had been sleeping at an auto camp on the Grandview Highway. In a few days, committees developed for food, water, and sanitation. They drew up strict rules. Single men and women slept on different floors, and there was to be no cooking in the rooms, or children playing in the hall. But soon, there were children's playrooms, including a fenced area on the panorama roof.
You must have been quite pleased that you were able to get them to do something.
Well, we were.
Yeah. Was it kind of fun living in the hotel? Some people have told me that, people who lived there.
Well, yes, it was. It was fun. It was quiet. The rooms were spacious. The bathtubs were 7 feet long.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was the elevators all worked.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, it was good.
Everyone said it was a very comfortable place to stay, great big bathrooms, kind of luxurious. I talked to a couple of vets two or three vets who remembered being there, or their wives who remembered this whole situation, and they said, it was kind of a party atmosphere. Everybody was relatively young. They'd come back from the war. They were in a celebratory mood, so it was kind of a fun. Most of them had fond memories of staying there, yeah. But then
my there was just nothing available, like even basement suites or rooms or anything.
Ah.
I was living with my mother and dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I got married, and we lived with my mother and dad. There was no other place to go until the hotel opened up.
It was pretty much full, if I remember correctly. Mm. That's a long time ago. The rent for the room that we had was $25 a month. As a matter of fact, that had been a $25 a day room.
Oh, in the hotel?
Yeah, even in those years.
You heard that right. A $25 a day room that was now renting for the same amount over 1 month.
So I joined the Army in that hotel, and they had a big cafeteria in the basement.
Okay, all right.
Was very reasonable.
They had what we called a canteen. You know what it was. It was a restaurant sort of place. And of course, you had to pay for your meals.
So, but you weren't supposed to cook in your room or anything like that? No, okay. Did anybody cook in the rooms?
Yes, we all cooked in our rooms.
Now, can you tell me something about the atmosphere in the hotel? I've heard that it was kind of a bit of a fun place because there were so many young people there. I don't know.
It was. As a matter of fact, it got a little bit too much fun. So they restricted the single women to one floor and the single men to another, and the rest of the floors were taken up with married couples.
By the end of 1946, an agreement declared the vets were safe in their new homes until 1948. The families had a roof over their head, but negotiations weren't over. In June of 1947, several hundred of the tenants struck against a 10% rent increase, refusing to pay. When the mayor hinted at the possibility of evictions before adequate housing could be found, the person in charge of the tenants' committee warned him that public opinion is soon going to force a showdown. In the meantime, the government knew they really had to do something in terms of housing, and the veterans knew they could not live there forever. There were petitions calling for 1,000 homes to be built in Vancouver. The group in charge of running the hotel declared it unsafe and beyond repair in 1948. The city complained it was costing enormous amounts of money to maintain.
And they established then a couple of places in Vancouver for veterans housing, and one was Renfrew Heights, but there were a couple of other places as well where they provided cheap rent, or houses that were pretty cheap to rent. Yeah.
In 1948, there were about 1,200 people now living in the hotel, and 400 houses in the Grandview area were earmarked for them.
And I received one out on Venable Street in East Hastings. And then we lived in that for a few years so we could afford to move into something better.
600 families moved into Renfrew Heights. One by one, people left the hotel and moved into cottage homes and apartments. In April of 1948, more than 2 years after the vets had moved in, headline read, "Death knell rings for Old Vancouver." The T. Eaton Company announced it would demolish the building in August to make way for a new department store.
To continue operation for another winter would impose the necessity of replacing heating, sanitary, and wiring systems in order to ensure the safety of tenants, and costs would be prohibitive.
And by the end of the summer, all of the tenants were gone. But the building wasn't torn down immediately. That happened the following spring. Souvenir hunters showed up in January of 1949. Everyone wanted something from the not-to-be-forgotten Spanish Grill. One man bought a complete marble staircase for a house he was building in the British Properties in West Vancouver. The 7-foot bathtubs went the fastest. Most envied was the tub that Winston Churchill splashed in. And the giant gargoyles, which looked out across Vancouver from their perches high atop the 15-story building, found resting places in Stanley Park, along the wooded pathways that thread through the trees. The Vancouver Daily Province declared the demolition the biggest wreckage in the city's history. It lasted over 10 months and cost close to $1 million. When it was time to haul the rubble away, one familiar man returned.
Coincidentally, by that time I was in the trucking business.
Bob McEwen came back to the hotel.
And I got the contract from the Cleveland Wrecking Company to haul all the debris away. I didn't make any money. As a matter of fact, I guess I just about went broke on it. But we had to dump it for free. And then the drive-in theater out at New Westminster on off Lovie, we built those tiers, you know, how they park on tiers.
Mm-hmm.
We built those out of the debris.
Life could not have predicted that the same person who led the fight to save the hotel would be one of the few to carry it away in pieces. To add insult, he didn't get paid. Another coincidence was hidden in the paneling of one of the hotel walls. It was an illustrated guide to Vancouver for visitors, published in 1913. The surprising part was that the same address of the hotel's builders was also the address of the wreckers on 782 Howe Street. The city grew around the block at Georgia and Granville. After they tore the hotel down, it sat as a parking lot for 30 years, before the Pacific Mall officially started building its $95 million shopping center, which stands there today.
I came upon this because I wrote a book about a friend of mine called Kurt Lang. The book was called At the World's Edge, and he was one of the few kids who lived in the hotel because his father was a serviceman, and when he came home from the war, there was no place for him to stay, and he was able to get into the hotel, and he stayed there with Kurt, my friend, and his wife. Yeah, so he was 12 when he lived in the hotel, and for him it was kind of an interesting place to be for a kid. He would get his bike and roam all over downtown, and he had quite a good time.
So my name is Will Woods, and I am the founder and chief storyteller at Forbidden Vancouver Walking Tours.
Thank you. And was there anything else you wanted to say about this?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
Thank you to Will Woods and especially Claudia Cornwell for sharing her recorded interviews, Tom Holliston for the use of his voice, and Rowan Chapman for his rendition of Django Reinhardt's Minor Swing. My name is Carrie Swigum, and you are listening to CJSF.
This documentary is part of the Making Time for Radio series funded by CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, on unceded Coast Salish territories. Listen to the whole series on soundcloud.com/CJSF.
Hello, I'm Madeline Taylor. You're listening to a documentary produced for CJSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. This is I Am a Fruit Tree.
This is my island in the sun, where my people have toiled since time begun. I may sail on many a sea, her shores will always be home to me.
Simon Fraser University has a bit of a reputation. It's known to be dark, the architecture is often compared to a prison, and everyone complains about the commute. Because we all commute, it's hard to make friends on the mountain. As a student, it's easy to let this stereotype dictate your experience. We fall into the tyranny of the urgent. It's tempting to plug in, power through, and ignore the world around you. Thankfully, there are characters at SFU who break this mold every day.
I'm Shiraz Ramji. I was born in Tanzania, East Africa, on 10th December 1948. At present, I'm 66 years old. That is about 24,000 days, because I love to count my age in days, and I can celebrate my birthday every day. I'm an educator. I'm trained as a teacher and also as a gerontologist, and I call myself a justice-friendly pacifist.
Shiraz is very well known at SFU for a few different reasons. He has lectured, worked, and studied all over campus since 1994. I first met Shiraz when I was a student. He was standing in a main concourse with a smile, giving out copies of his poetry. He wears sports clothes emblazoned with SFU logos and walks like he's late for something. What is striking about him is his lack of pretense. He doesn't expect anything from you when he offers his poetry. It's simply an open invitation to engage. I found this so unusual and couldn't quite figure out what his motivation was. As it turns out, Shiraz is a peace activist. He told me he's been writing poetry since he was a young boy. He calls it part of his activism and uses poetry to start conversations and spread his message of justice-friendly peace.
It was mostly grade 5 or 6 somewhere where the teacher said, "You speak like a poet." I didn't know what he meant, but he says, "Write whatever you are speaking." And he would read it and he said, "This is poetry and you should write it all the time." One day I realized the price of photocopier at my student union was 4 cents. So I said, "Oh, I can afford that." So I said, "Okay, I'll spend $2 every day for my poetry." So I started printing them. And then I started sharing them. That was about 12 years ago.
Shiraz doesn't only do this at SFU. He approaches people in every part of his daily life.
That's always a challenge, whom I should ask. But sometimes it can be like this morning. There was a woman on the SkyTrain, she was reading about elementary educators. So I said, "Oh, I am an educator." So I asked her, "Do you read poetry and where do you study?" And I said, "I write poetry." So I gave her one. So it depends. If I know, like SFU students, is very easy. So I just tell them, "I write poetry. Do you read poetry?" And then they say yes. So I said, "Take one." And if they don't want it, then I say, "Thank you. Okay, next." But even if I didn't have poetry, I would just talk to people. So that has always been my lifestyle.
Back at SFU, Shiraz took me around to some of his favorite parts of campus. On this little walking tour, I discovered that homemade hummus is another tool he uses to connect.
Hi, here she is. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, Shiraz.
How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so nice to see you.
Nice. I'm thinking of your ice cream all the time.
I love it.
So my name is Sarah Manassian, and I'm the fitness programmer at SFU Recreation. When I think of Shiraz, I just think of this warm, smiling guy. He would come into the fitness center, and he'd always bring us pita and homemade hummus. And it was staffs, like, would get excited about, like, "Oh, it's Sunday, Shiraz is coming in. He's going to bring his, like, pita and homemade hummus." And we just loved that. That's probably one of my fondest memories, because it would happen every weekend, like, without stop. And I think that kind of made our fitness center more of a community, too, because people would actually come in on the weekends because they knew Shiraz was going to come to bring pita and hummus, and they come in on the weekends, so we'd all sit around and eat the hummus that Shiraz would bring.
He got this reaction constantly. What I wanted to know was what in his life led Shiraz to be so open with his community. After getting to know him better, I started to understand the root of his activism.
Well, you see, when I grew up in Tanzania, I was born in 1948, so I started schooling in 1954. And So it was still part of British colony, and so you see all the racism and segregation of all the different racial groups and so on. So you knew what was colonialism, what is dictatorship, and you hear about all the wars and stuff like that. There were schools which were for European settlers, and then there were Asian schools, and there were African schools. Yeah, like even the buses, that segregated place. You had to, like, you got the movies, you had to stand up because you had to sing the God Save the King and stuff like that. So we all knew that, and the whole glorification of Britain, how good it is. And it was legally that way, but it... So some people assimilated with the whole thing and accepted their second-class status. I wasn't very keen on that, so it was there all the time.
Tanzania achieved independence from British colonial rule in 1961. To the south, Mozambique was under Portuguese colonial rule. They endured a decade of anti-colonial struggle, followed by a civil war through the 1970s and 80s. In the 1970s, Shiraz taught in Tanzania. There, he supported the African Liberation Movement and its activists.
It was part of the anti-colonial struggle in Tanzania itself. We were quite influenced by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Angela Davis. So it was at a global level as well as local level, there was all issue of anti-apartheid.
These experiences of colonial violence, segregation, and oppression have made Shiraz very aware of the dangers of focusing on difference.
I mean, I met a lot of the present and the past leaders of South Africa or Mozambique and so on. So they would come to our school and give a talk. So it has been very much part of my struggle, yeah.
By the early 1990s, after decades of working in education, in medical research, in public health, and in refugee advocacy in East Africa, Shiraz was looking for a change. Both of his parents had passed away, and his partner was killed in a bicycle accident while studying in London.
Well, I was in Africa at that time, and she was finishing her master's in nutrition. And that's when it happened. So we were studying together at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So I got the news from family and so on of that happened, because she was going to join me. So that was quite tragic. But then I didn't know what to tell people because I'd moved from Tanzania to Zimbabwe. So they didn't know her, right? So it was very hard to tell people. So that was on time when I was on my own. At that level, I'm more of a private person. Like, I wouldn't talk much with about these things, generally, unless people ask me. So when it came to 94, my mission was at least to be involved with anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, and then independence came in April 94. Mother had passed, my father had also passed in Africa. After the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa was become more independent struggles, right, I wanted a break. And my sister was very ill, so I came to Canada.
Shiraz's transition to Canada was eased by his entry into community life at SFU. A student and an educator for his whole life, he was comfortable at school.
So here is our library. So this is what I call the holy place, the holy land, SFU holy land. It's for everybody.
Shiraz talks a lot about globalizing friendship and how this can be done through sharing food with your community. Food was a central theme in all of the conversations I had with Shiraz. This is Celeste. She taught Shiraz when he took a movement class at SFU.
There was an unforgettable story. Every student in the class is required to teach the rest of the class a dance. It could be a circle dance, a folk dance, but they have to make it up from scratch. Shiraz taught us a dance called the hummus dance. It was like a group dance around food globalization, and we danced the hummus, we made the hummus through dance. The joy that he brought to this piece and the love that he brought to this piece was so truly moving.
Shiraz doesn't believe in the idea of strangers. He thinks it allows for fear and separation.
Because I don't have many family members, so I just interact with people as if they are part of the family. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going in the morning exercise, I'm filling up with the community. And so it's a way to break the barrier of being lonely or isolated.
To be honest, I don't know what the words are for it. I feel a feeling when I think of Shiraz. I think maybe the thing that's different about him is he'll engage anybody and everybody. He's just so welcoming. He's so open. He'll come up, he'll give you a hug, he'll speak smiles. Have you read my poetry lately? Here's what's going on. Do you want some hummus? I'm going to bring you some food. Like, it's every time that you see him.
As I said, I always want to know, first to create that community and make people not be afraid of me or anybody else. But also to hear stories of people in terms of not necessarily private stories, but how do they look at life and how do they respond to people like me. So it gives me a feeling that there are many people who want to create that community, but somebody has to start. Almost every case, I'm the one who starts, and then the ball starts rolling.
I love the sense of his deep curiosity for life. To me, that's what SFU was all about. Now I look around at SFU and I see them all. They look absolutely, everyone looks bored to death. You get Shiraz walking through here. He just has a love of life. And you know, it doesn't even need a cell phone.
So it turns out that Shiraz isn't well known at SFU because of his longevity. It's because he reminds people of what they really want from campus. Community and a sense of belonging.
SFU is a happy place, and it's also a place with some challenges. Happiness in a sense, there's a diversity of people. It can be sadness because the education system, so a lot of education is very Eurocentric. And there are a lot of slogans like critical learning or critical thinking, but essentially it's more conformist education. So it can be challenging for you. I normally consider every person is a fruit tree, so I said just enjoy the fruit.
Why a fruit tree?
Well, I was surrounded. I grew up with so many fruit trees. Papayas grow in 9 months. I used to plant a lot of fruit trees. And I think it's a universal food. There's no recipe for fruit trees. It's just fruit. So I thought as a global citizen, it fits in my narrative.
What does community mean to you?
Community is like what I call the fruit salad, right? Where you have a mixture of everybody around. So it's much of a collective experience. I mean, there are a collective experience in SFU, for example. It's a community, right?
His outlook is contagious. But here's the thing. What is a community? A community is a group of people with something in common, but it's often described as a sense. You feel a sense of community. It's not something that geographic locations just have on their own. Shiraz's approach is to make every space into a community.
I believe we all have the capacity to touch into something that is invisible, that is greater than us, on however you articulate it. But it is a love that infuses far beyond the imagination and far beyond our daily living, because our daily living is fraught with so many difficulties. And I think Shiraz has probably had experiences enough to have to empty himself, where he then is tapped into this greater source of love. And I'm not going to articulate certain labels around that, but I believe he embodies love.
I tell people, I believe that I'm not the only Shiraz in the world. There are many people in Shiraz in the world. And, for example, I can relate to you because I see Shiraz in you and you see yourself in me, right? So don't assume you're alone.
His poetry is not only in print, it's the impression he leaves on people. His embodiment of the fruit tree allows him to connect and create openness and curiosity in the people he meets. He makes eye contact, simple conversation, and impacts SFU by building community through the simple act of constant and unapologetic engagement.
That's what I tell people. Take your part. If you need help, come and have a tea with me.
Well, on that note, can you share a poem or two with us?
Yeah, okay, I'll share with you the one, my favorite one, which is my autobiography of as a child. It's called Be a Mother Earth. I'm a fruit tree. I'm a fruitful tree. I'm a banana tree. I grow bananas shaped like human lips to share and tell stories with my global friends. I'm a cherry tree. I grow cherries shaped like human eyes.
This documentary was produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I would also like to thank Shiraz Ramji, Celeste Snober, Sarah Manassian, and Victoria Haraway for their voices and stories.
her shores will always be home to me.